you a little better.
Went for a shawarma, I felt much better.
You need the body to serve the self. So, in this parsha, of course, we have two different aspects of Yaakov supposedly tricking Esav. One is the lentils, when Yaakov, as it were, buys what is called the Bechorah. And later we have the Bracha. So first, a matter of chronology. How old was Yaakov and Esav with the transaction of the lentils, the Adoshim? Which is actually why Esav is called Edom, right? Esav is not called Edom because he had a ruddy complexion. Esav became known as Edom because of his desire for that red soup, lentil soup. So it was, they have two types of, they have lentil soup, Indian lentil soup, and regular Indian lentil soup is lighter brown. So this must be a non-Indian lentil soup. And how old were they? So Rashi says a very important bit of chronology. Rashi says, Yaakov 15 years old. They were twins. How do we know they were 15? Because Chazal had a mesorah that the reason Yaakov was cooking the lentils was lentils is the food you give a mourner, an avel, because it's round, or, you know, because it represents the notion that life has good times, but it turns around to a bad time, turns around to a good time, etc. And Yaakov wanted to be Menachem, Yitzchak, his father, over the loss of Avraham Avinu. Okay? Now, given that assumption, the chronology now becomes clear. Because Yaakov and Esav were born when Yitzchak was 60. That's what it says in the Chumash. Yitzchak was born when Avraham was 100. So Yaakov and Esav were born when Avraham was 160 years old. Avraham lived 175 years old. That's also in the Chumash. So consequently, you can figure out that when Avraham Avinu died, Yaakov and Esav were 15 years old, right? So this was a very young, relatively young stage. Now the question becomes exactly, I guess we can ask two questions. Number one, what exactly is Yaakov buying? Because we don't find anywhere else in the Chumash that Yaakov is using this point. Yaakov gets brachos later, etc. But that's much, much later. So what is this birthright that Yaakov Avinu is purchasing, right? He proposes to Esav, sell me your birthright. Esav says, behold, I am going to die. Why do I need a birthright? So B'pashtus, this refers to the idea that before the Chet HaEgel, even after the Jews left Mitzrayim, the right of divine service to bring korbanos, to serve Hashem, to be the Kohen of the family, you know, Lahavdil, maybe I should use this as an example. In Irish families, they had a tradition that the oldest child becomes a priest, the next child becomes a policeman, and the third becomes a fireman. That's in all the Irish families, it's, you know, priest, policeman, fireman. So Lahavdil, maybe they got it from us. Lahavdil, the concept was, and before there were Kohanim, only as a result of the Egel did HaKadosh Baruch Hu replace the system of Bechor with Kohanim. There was a concept that a Bechor was the one who was primarily connected to spirituality. Now, what's a little shver with that is, it's mashma from the Torah that the firstborn was sanctified as a result of Makas Bechoros. In other words, the realm of the Bechor is a very limited one, from Yetzias Mitzrayim to the Chet HaEgel. But on the other hand, the narrative here indicates that a Bechor had a Zechus of Avaida, even prior to Yetzias Mitzrayim, even prior to the Jewish people, so to speak. So Yaakov is essentially buying from Esav the idea of having, being of doing the Avodah. Now the question is that something you can sell? I mean, by analogy to a Kohen, I couldn't go to a Kohen and say, sell me your Kahuna. But the answer would be that this is not really a halachic sale. This is really more in the nature of a spiritual renunciation. That Esav is showing that he cares much more about the material world than he cares about the spiritual world. And Esav's willingness to relinquish this Sechus shows that he's not worthy. So it's not really a sale in that sense. It is rather an indication that Esav is not worthy. Again, look at his language. Behold, I'm going to die. Meaning, why do I care about Ruchnius? Why do I care about my soul? There is no soul. I'm going to die. After I die, there's nothing there. What do I need this korbanos and everything else? So Chazal actually say a very interesting thing. They actually say Esav did not publicly become a kofer until the day Avram died. For the 15 years his life overlapped with Avram, Esav did not behave like a Rasha. He was a hunter, this and that, but he was not a Rasha. One might think perhaps because the influence of his grandfather, this is still true, kids who go off the derech might have a problem with their parents, but they can often be very connected to their grandparents. As long as the grandparent is around, the child can be very, very good. The grandparent dies, the child goes off the derech totally. You might see this with Esav. So that's one issue. What did Yaakov sell? So we would answer, I'm sorry, what did Yaakov buy? Yaakov bought the right to do the divine service, but it was not really in the nature of a sale. It was in the nature of renunciation, indicating that Esav was not on a madrega. The second aspect people ask is, okay, what about the fact that in effect Yaakov is taking advantage of Esav's vulnerabilities? Esav is starving. Now Esav says he's going to die. Okay, even if it wasn't literally, probably was not literally pikuach nefesh. Esav was probably not going to drop dead if he didn't eat. But Esav is certainly famished, and if a person is very hungry, a person might agree to all sorts of things. Right? So, is that fair? So in a sense, the way I've explained it, it's not so much of a kasha, because if, it's not merely the fact that Esav says take it, but Esav says it in such a way, I don't need it, I don't want it, it means nothing to me. The lashon of the Chumash is vayivez, he despises it. Right? He just doesn't want it, he doesn't care about it. But there is a pshat from one of the great 19th century Mefarshim, which is not a very common sefer, but it's a very, very well-regarded sefer, called Haksav v'Hakabbalah. A little background about this sefer. The 19th century, you know, we have to be grateful to the Reform movement, for one thing. And, you know, who knows if Hashem will give them reward for this. The Reform movement started in the 19th century, first in Germany, and it spread to Hungary. Now, a lot of what the Reform movement was, they were like Karaites in a sense. They said, well, we believe in the Torah, at least initially, but we don't believe in all of this artificial rabbinic stuff that makes things up and everything else. So a lot of it was a denigration of Chazal and Torah Shebal Peh and the like. So in order to counter the Reform, there were many, many great Mefarshim on Chumash that were written in the 19th century to show how Chazal's interpretations are not artificial or fake, but they're based on a deep grammatical structure and understanding. And this was to combat a lot of the arguments of the Reform. So what Sfarim am I talking about? The Malbim. The Malbim wrote specifically to kind of deal with the Reform attack on Torah Shabbat Peh. And many Gedolim thought they didn't like what the Malbim was doing. The Malbim was a guy in Ilam, a Gadol Ador. He should write on Gemara, Chidusha. Why is he writing on Chumash and Nach and all that stuff? And the Malbim said, if you get somebody else to do this, I'll go back to Gemara. But, you know, this is needs. Actually, the Malbim. The other was Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch. The third was a sefer called the Ksav HaKabbalah, which I'll talk about, right? Ksav HaKabbalah. Ksav is Torah Shebichsav. Kabbalah is the received Torah Shebal Peh, and he tries to be Mechaber, Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebal Peh. The fourth was Rav David Hoffman, and then you also have a little later, the Meshech Chochma and the Netziv, right? So in a way, the 19th century had an unusually large number of very, very great Perushim on Chumash written by Gedolei Olam, who were primarily halachic scholars, and yet they devoted their energies to Perushim on Chumash. So essentially, there wouldn't have been a Reform movement, they wouldn't have written all of these Sfarim. So these Sfarim came into the world because of the Reform movement. Now, the Reform movement would not be pleased, but nevertheless, they were the indirect cause for all of this. So be it as it may, the Ksav HaKabbalah is one of those very, very great Sfarim. It's not used that much today, but it is a very, very esteemed sefer. And he makes a very fascinating point, a very interesting grammatical point that's really quite amazing. You know, one of the phenomena of biblical Hebrew is what is called the Vav HaMahapech. The Vav HaMahapech is a Vav, which normally means and, but in biblical Hebrew, a Vav before a verb converts the tense of the verb. So, for example, let's take Vayomer. Very simple word. Vayomer, Vayidaber. Now, Yidaber alone is future. He will talk. But when it says Vayidaber, converts the future into the past. Right? You're familiar with that phenomenon, right? Vayidaber Hashem is not Hashem will speak, but Hashem spoke. This is called the Vav HaMahapech, the Vav that reverses, and this is an extinct rule. In other words, this does not carry over in modern Hebrew, but in biblical Hebrew, that is a phenomenon. There's a machlokus among translators, by the way. When the Vav serves the function of reversing tenses, do you still translate it as an and? Some say when the Vav is serving the reversal of a tense, it is not a conjunction. On the other hand, other translations do say, that's why you'll see in some Chumashim, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe, and the Lord spoke to Moshe. Some will translate it, the Lord spoke to Moshe, they will not look at the Vav as a conjunction when it serves there. So in most of Tanakh, you very rarely have a straight past word. In other words, the vast majority of past tenses are future words with a Vav in front of it. Right? You very rarely have a pure past. Now, when you do have a pure past, let's say it says, I don't think there's any pasuk that says this, but I'll show you one example. Let's say you'd have a pasuk that would say, instead of saying, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe, let's say we had a pasuk that says, Diber Hashem el Moshe, which is a pure past. How would you translate that? God spoke to Moshe, so the answer is no. You would translate it, here I have to be a little grammatical, you would translate it as a what's called a past perfect. And not that God spoke to Moshe, but God had spoken to Moshe, meaning it's prior to the point that's being described. So, this will become clear when I show you the Ksava Kabbalah's point. Is there a Chumash here? I have to read you something from the actual passage.
One thing that you do, when I is that an SB cousin of that, you took my grandfather over the first one. I'm wearing it.
Yeah, thank you. Vayomer Yaakov, Hishav Ali Kayom. Yaakov says to Esav, swear to me that you are renouncing the Bechorah, Vayishav Alo, and he swore to him, Vayimkor Es Bechoroso LiYaakov, and he sold his right to Yaakov. Now, next Pasuk says, and by the way, you see, right, all of the past words are really future with above, right? Vayishav Alo, and he swore to him, Vayimkor. Next pasuk says, "V'Yaakov nosan li'Esav." Yaakov gave Esav the bread and the lentils. Now this is very unusual. It doesn't say. It should have said, right? Because "Va'yishav alo, va'yimkar lo, va'yiten lo." He swore, he sold, and Yaakov gave. But here it unusually drops the vav, and it uses a straight past, and Yaakov gave. So the Ksava Kabbalah says the way you translate it is that Esav swore, Esav sold, because Yaakov had already given him food to eat. It's a past perfect. And therefore the concept, according to the Ksava Kabbalah, is not that Yaakov told him, give me the Bechorah and then I'll give you the food. Rather, he gave Esav the food, and after Esav had already eaten, Esav then says, fine, take the Bechorah, who needs it. And his diuk is, because V'Yaakov Nasan is not a sequential past. Otherwise it should have said, if it's giving you an order of events, it should have said, V'Yishav Alo, V'Yimkar Lo, Ve'yitein li'Esav. Yaakov Nasan is Yaakov had already given. Now, this is a very, very fascinating grammatical chiddush. We have to admit that none of the other Mepharshim learns this way. Again, Kemat, all of the Mepharshim understand that Yaakov was holding back on the food until Esav agreed. But the Ksava Kabbalah does learn in a way that Yaakov was not taking advantage of Esav. They tell a Hasidic story. It's a cute story about a poor man who had to marry off his daughter, right? So he goes to the Rebbe and says, I don't have any money. So the Rebbe says, listen, just buy, how much money do you have? He says, I have 2 rubles, little amount of money. Okay, just buy the first thing that is offered to you and hold on to it. So this Jew walks in, he walks into an inn, a tavern, and there are other Jews sitting around who are not so religious, drinking and playing cards, and they see like this Haredi guy, you know, walking in, and they think they're going to have they think he's a simpleton probably, naive, so they're going to have some good fun at his expense. They say, Rebbe Yid, what are you doing here? He says, well, the Rebbe says, I have to buy something, and I don't know what to buy, I'm not in business. He says, how much you have? He says, 2 rubles. He says, okay, I tell you what, you give me 2 rubles, I'll give you my Olam Haba. So the person said, okay, the Rebbe said, whatever I'm offered, I should buy. Here's 2 rubles, but we have to have a document. We have to draw it up. So it's all part of a big joke. So the guy draws up a big document. He has his friend sign. And he gets 2 rubles, and the naive chassid now has a star that says he owes the Olam Haba of this guy in the inn. So the guy in the inn comes home to his wife and says, I have to tell you today, he tells a big joke, and he says, you know, we had this naive, you know, chinyak, this naive religious guy, and you know, I just got the easiest 2 rubles, I just gave my Olam Haba, and, you know, etc. And he notices as he's telling the story that his wife is not laughing. He figured his wife would laugh and enjoy the joke. He says, what's the matter? Don't you see the humor of it? He says, no, I don't. I'm not going to live with a man who doesn't have his Olam Haba. Go and buy it back. So he's embarrassed. He says, listen, this is nothing. I mean, this is a stupid little game. You can't sell your Olam Haba. He said, go and buy it back. So he finds the Jew. He says, listen, you know, I know I feel sorry. I made fun of you. Just here's your 2 rubles. Just give me back the star, you know. So the Jew says, I'm sorry. The Rebbe said to buy, not to sell. The Rebbe doesn't say to sell. He says, I'll give you 4. I'll give you 6. I'll give you 8. I'll give you 10. He says, no. The Rebbe said to sell. To buy, not to sell. So he goes back to his wife and says, all right, listen, I was willing to humor you. I'm willing to give him back 2 and 4 and 6 and 8, but, you know, I mean, he's not selling for any price. So she says, I don't care. You got to get it back. So he doesn't know what to do. So finally, they both go to the Chassidish Rebbe. And the Chassidish Rebbe says to the poor man, he says, how much money you need to make chasna? He says, well, I need around 1,000 rubles. So he tells the man, pay him 1,000 rubles. So he runs back to his wife and says, what is going on? 1,000 rubles. Wife says, you pay 1,000 rubles, yeah? So he pays 1,000 rubles, he gets back the shtar, his wife is happy. And he then says to the Rebbe, he says, Rebbe, where's the yashrus here? Where's the justice here? I took 2 rubles from the guy, and I have to pay him back 1,000 rubles? So the Rebbe said, when you were willing to sell your Olam Haba for 2 cents, all it was worth was 2 cents. But when you're willing to pay 1,000 rubles for your Olam Haba, it's worth a lot more. What is, so really, you didn't get cheated. You got something back more valuable than what you sold. But when you sold it, it wasn't even worth what you got for it. So the lesson of the story is that the reward that Hashem gives us, you know, for our mitzvah is kind of commensurate not only with what we do, but how important we consider it. When we consider our relationship to Hashem important, it becomes more valuable. So this is the concept here. Did Yaakov cheat Esav? Yaakov took his bechira, Esav's bechira, for a pot of beans? The answer is, if Esav is willing to sell his bechira for a pot of beans, that's all it's worth. It's not worth anything more. Esav didn't get cheated. Esav's Olam Haba, which is represented by his Bechira, wasn't worth anything if he's willing to get rid of it for no reason at all. Okay. But what's interesting is that this occurred when they were 15, and then we really don't hear, about this again. Meaning, Esav, we find, well, Esav has one reference to it. Esav says, did they call him Yaakov because he tricked me twice? Esav does say, he tricked me twice. He took my bechora, and now he took my brachos. But really, it's very, very clear that even in later years, Esav's anger is not because of the bechora. Esav Taka doesn't care about it. Esav's anger is because of the bracha, which we'll see is more connected to Eretz Yisrael and Gashmias and the like. So even Achar HaMaisa, Esav is not particularly angry about this. He really didn't care. Even afterwards, he just brought it up as an additional taina against Yaakov when Yaakov took the brachos, which was something Esav did care about, because we're going to see that the brachos are connected to who owns Eretz Yisrael, who has the right to live in Eretz Yisrael, and the like. Yep.
So, I mean, everyone must have noticed that now Yaakov was doing the avodah and not Esav.
Yes.
So, I mean, everyone knew, and he sort of lived with it.
That's a very good point. If avodah meant some actual activity of bringing korbanos, this would have been a public event, right? So people knew, and apparently people accepted the fact that Esav just gave it up. And maybe it wasn't totally unique either. It could be, in other words, this concept, maybe there were other families as well, we don't know, where a Bechor gave up the Avaita to somebody else. Now, the Mishnah goes right on with other, I'm trying to say, the Chumash goes right on with other things in the life of Yitzchak. There's a famine. Yitzchak goes to the land of the Plishtim. The land of the Plishtim is in Eretz Yisrael. It's the Mediterranean coast. The Plishtim had five cities along the Mediterranean coast. Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gaz, Ekron. These were the Philistine cities on the Mediterranean. Yitzchak did not go to Mitzrayim. Again, Rashi makes the point that because Yitzchak had been sanctified as a korban, Yitzchak was not allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael. That's why Eliezer had to find a wife for him. Yitzchak couldn't go, and that's why during the Rav he doesn't go either. In the land of the Plishtim, he almost kind of has an imitation of what happened to Avraham twice, with Abimelech, the king of the Plishtim, etc. But in addition, it tells us that Yitzchak or his servants dug various wells, and the Plishtim filled up the wells. And the Torah goes into some detail here. The Torah says there was one well that they dug, and it was filled up. Now, why would the Philistines do that? Why wouldn't they just steal the well? Because, once again, they wanted Yitzchak not to feel that he had a presence in the land. That's why we say the 400 years of exile begins with the birth of Yitzchak. Because although Yitzchak never left the land of Israel, but even in Eretz Israel, Yitzchak was margish as a stranger. So the first well goes by the name Asek. The second well goes by the name Sitna. And the third well, which the Plishtim did not fill up, goes by the name Rechovos. Now, Esek is translated as quarrel. Sitna is translated as hatred. And Rechovos is, like the city Rechovos, is expansiveness. That God has now given me expansiveness in the land. So there's a very fascinating comment of the Ramban of why the Chumash teaches us about these wells. The Ramban often uses the Maimer Chazal that says, Maisa Avais Simen Labanim. Maisa Avais. What happens to our Avais is a sign of what's going to happen to us. So he says, the Be'eros are a remez to the Beis HaMikdash. There are going to be two temples that get destroyed, and the Bayis HaShlishi is never going to be Nechrem. So he says the first well is a remez to the first Beis HaMikdash. And that's why it is called Esek. Now, even though the Pashtus of the Pasuk is Esek is quarrel between the Plishtim and Yitzchak, but it can also refer to the quarrel between Bnei Yisrael and Hashem, because the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed for three primary Averis, Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayot, Shvichas Damim. But the biggest of the three Averis was Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is a quarrel with Hashem. It's a rejection of God. So Esek, Zakta Ramban, is a remez to the chait of Avodah Zarah. The second well is called Sitna. Sitna means hatred. This is a remez to the Beis HaMikdash. that was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70. And according to Chazal, although most of the Jews were relatively righteous, they were keeping mitzvahs, but the reason for the Chorban Bayis Sheni was not regular Shrichas Damim, but it was the chait of sinas chinam, hatred, irrational hatred, polarization. And of course, keep in mind that the Gemara Yuma says that the first Beis HaMikdash, that the worst Averis, Avodah Zarah L'Shrichas Damim, the Golus was only 70 years. The Chorban of Sinas Chinam is still today. And the third Beis HaMikdash is called Rechavos, expansiveness, because we have a Mesorah that the third Mikdash is never going to be destroyed. And therefore, and also, even literally, it's going to be much bigger. Yerushalayim is going to be bigger. The Mikdash is going to be bigger. So that's the notion of Rechavos, expansiveness. So he says the whole remez is every single deed of the Avos is a remez. The Ramban goes through this in great detail. He says, for example, Avram going to Mitzrayim is a remez, and he left with great wealth, is a remez that we will be in Mitzrayim and we will leave with great wealth, right, etc. The Plishtim, story of Plishtim, is a remez to David HaMelech encountering the Philistines and waging war against them. So it's as if everything in the life of the Avos foreshadows what's going to happen to the Bavli. A related point, you know, the Teichacha appears. Teichacha are the awesome curses that will befall Am Yisrael when we reject the Torah. The Tochacha appears two places in the Torah with different words. There is a Tochacha at the end of Vayikra, which is Parshas Bechukosai, and then there's a Teichacha at the end of Parshas Kisavo in Devarim. So the Ramban says there, the first Teichacha is a remez to the Chorban Bayis Rishayim, and the second Teichacha is a remez to the Chorban Bayis Sheni, and he points out that is why the end of the first Teichacha, it talks about Hashem will bring you back to the land, because the first Chorban, there was a predetermined duration of the Golus, 70 years. The second Teichacha does not end with Hashem saying, I'll bring you back to the land, because the second Chorban has no predetermined duration. It depends on our tshuva. We can bring it immediately or much, much later. And as a result, the Torah is merames in the second Teichacha that it's all up to us. The Geula is totally on B'nai Yisrael doing tshuva. Of course, that's a little difficult because L'maisa, it's true that obviously the second Golus is much, much longer than 70 years. On the other hand, there is an outer time when Mashiach has to come, whether we're ready or not. In other words, it's not true to say if we didn't do tshuva, there would be no Geula at all. But Pashtus, there will be a Geula. But it does mean the duration will be far, far, far in the future unless we accelerate it by doing tshuva. Also, in the second Teichacha, there's a remez not only to the Chorban Bayis Sheni, but also to all the tzaras that happened afterwards, the Holocaust, many, many references to the Holocaust can be... I mean, the Ramban obviously didn't point these out. But if you look for psukim that describe, you know, eating your children, and God forbid, and all of those different things, it does correspond with things that happened during the Holocaust itself. So that was the Maisa Avais, Simon Labani. Okay, let's see. Okay, so we'll stop here for now. But so what we're going to do tomorrow, Mr. Shem, is we're going to discuss the final event in the parsha, and that's the issue of Yaakov taking the brachos from Yitzchak. And this is one of the very difficult parshios in the Torah, just to get pashat pshat. I mean, number one, the morality of Yaakov's behavior. Well, okay, you could say, well, Yaakov is doing what his mother wants him to do. Okay, so we can ask the morality of Rivka's behavior. Number one, what is the morality of that behavior? Number two, what is Yitzchak's attitude? Why would he want, especially since, you know, Yaakov has been doing the Avaida for many years. What is Yitzchak's Havamina to want to give the brachos to Esav? And number three, why does the trick even work? If Yitzchak thinks he is blessing. I mean, this is not a magic spell here. I mean, in other words, brachos are not like some magic thing that if you're the right person, you know, you're the guy, you get it. It all depends on the kavana of the tzaddik giving you the blessing. If the tzaddik's kavana is to bring down the blessing of Hashem on a person whose name is Esav, then it's not going to work if somebody who's an impersonator is there. So these are like three, you know, basic questions in Pshat. Number one, how do we explain the morality of Yaakov and Rivka trying to deceive Yitzchak? Number two, how do we explain why Yitzchak needed to be deceived? And number three, why would the deception even work? Even if we were to assume, which is of course not the case, okay, Yaakov and Rivka are cheaters. Let them be cheaters. Why should the cheater get away with this? Aliba Diemes, Yitzchak was mechaven for Esav, so why would the bracha work? Now, number four, a fourth question we should discuss too, is exactly what bracha did Yaakov get here? In other words, did Yaakov get a bracha? I mean, Yaakov got a bracha seemingly, but you know, did he in fact get a bracha? Exactly was the bracha, what was the purpose of it, and how was it fulfilled in the history of the Jewish people? Maybe it wasn't fulfilled. Maybe the whole bracha is a messianic bracha. Right, so we'll talk about that.
Just a quick question with Yitzchak going to the Plishtim. Someone asked me recently that, did he not learn? I mean, Avraham Avinu already tried, you know, the trick twice already, and it didn't work. Is it also this simon for the future generations?
Yes, yes. In fact, this actually had some very, very amazing, difficult repercussions here. If you remember, Yitzchak made a treaty with Avimelech and Pichol is the general, in Be'er Sheva, the place Be'er Sheva, and that is that we would not wage war or have any aggression against me or my grandchildren, and one more generation, right? So it goes my son, my grandchildren, and one more generation, four generations. So the emphasis is, when you read in the book of Shmuel, when David HaMelech conquered Jerusalem, initially he was not able to do so. And according to Chazal, that is because there was still a fourth generation descendant of Avimelech still alive. And because of that bris, Yerushalayim could not be conquered until that person died. That, in a sense, such a bris should never have been made, because essentially Yitzchak was limiting the power of Bnei Yisrael to conquer the Harabayas, to conquer Eretz Yisrael, and the like.
And then the conceding of the fact that this woman is my wife, yeah. What is that merames to?
Well, it is merames to some degree to the fact that the Plishtim were mezaneh with Jewish women, and they would take Jewish women. So again, it's a remez that this would be something that we would face many, many times. And we would have to try to protect the situation one way or the other. But there's another idea here too, and the other idea is that, unlike Avram, who created a new derech in Avodas Hashem, Yitzchak's goal was to preserve Avram's heritage, to hold on to it, not to let go of it. As a result, the Torah's merames that in his very life he kind of imitates Avram's life. Avram went through it, he goes through it. There's a famine, Avram leaves. Well, Yitzchak can't leave totally, but he goes to the Plishtim. There is a concept in which there has to be a replay of Avram and Yitzchak, because Yitzchak's divine mission is to preserve the heritage of Avram. So Avram was out being makariv thousands of people. Yitzchak was there to hold on and preserve, as opposed to expand. Yitzchak was not, although he named the well Rechovos, but Yitzchak was not the Av of expansion. Yitzchak was preservation. And one aspect of preservation is he literally relives. He relives a number of experiences that Avraham Avinu reveals.
Rob, the story you told the other day, I think on Sunday, about the son who got sent away.
Yeah.
Rabbi Lev told us that's what happened to him.
He knew his story?
Yeah, because the boy got sent to him for counseling. Is that right?
Oh, it actually happened.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing.